It's Gracie,
Sarah,
and Josie
from the Girl Scout Troop 1819, Coxsackie, Athens.
And you're listening to
WGXC
ACRA
at 90.7 FM.
Keep on being you.
The Catskill Food Pantry is located in the Parish Hall of St. Luke's Episcopal Church at 50 William Street in Catskill. The pantry is open to the public every Friday from 1 to 4 p.m. Healthy food is a right. For more information, please feel welcome to visit the pantry, call us at 551-299-2456, check the website at catskillfoodpantry.org, or connect with us on Facebook at Catskill Food Pantry.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more. Plus, advance notice of close-up conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Socrates, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org/support. That's upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Eric and Bonnie Belgum in Schaefer, Minnesota. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, June the 27th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. Today is National HIV Testing Day. Terry D. reports it was first observed in the U.S. in 1995. Anyone who is sexually active is urged to get tested to know their HIV status.
The site HIV.gov underscores the importance of testing to show self-value, compassion, and respect. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, almost 14,000 Hoosiers are living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Alan Witchie heads the Damien Center, an HIV/AIDS resource in Indianapolis. Witchie says the blood test is free and confidential, and insurance is not required.
Nobody has to know that you're coming. And you can either make an appointment or you can just walk in. It's just a quick finger prick. You will have your results in 20 minutes.
He adds testing for other sexually transmitted diseases can be performed at the same time. A positive test result will alert the Damien Center staff to connect the person to support services and the clinic. For a negative result, medication is available for HIV prevention. I'm Terry D. reporting.
Ending the HIV epidemic in the U.S., or EHE, is a federal program with the aim of lowering new HIV infections nationwide by 75% by next year and at least 90% by 2030. And the headline from CNN is, it's a stunning accident. The Supreme Court appears poised to temporarily allow abortions in medical emergencies in Idaho. Bloomberg News reported Wednesday, citing a document that was inadvertently posted on the court's website, in an astonishing breach of protocol. They report the unsigned opinion showed that three conservatives, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, sided with the court's three liberals to block the state from enforcing the ban in certain emergency situations. CNN notes this is one of several cases the court has to rule on in this term. President Biden has made abortion rights a centerpiece of his reelection push, and the erroneous publication comes a day before the CNN debate. And some kids in New Mexico hope summer never ends, while others can't wait to get back in the classroom, but both groups are at risk.
Yaha Aguilera leads New Mexico's Save the Children organization. She says kids need help, especially those living in poverty, so they don't fall behind. She encourages parents to read books and tell stories to spark their children's curiosity. Aguilera says New Mexico has a lot of rural areas where it's more difficult to find support.
Some of the challenges for these parents are geographic isolation, the lack of resources.
She says when kids come back to school in the fall, it can take teachers at least 2 weeks to get them back up to speed if they have lapsed in learning over the summer. I'm Roz Brown.
This is Public News Service. Lawsuits are seeking to hold Amazon accountable for selling a chemical that was used by people for suicide. Eric Tigetoff explains.
The substance is known as sodium nitrite and is usually used as a food preservative at low concentrations. The families of 15 people who died from the substance have sued Amazon in six separate cases. Caitlin Cherf, an attorney in Seattle, is defending the family of Tyler Schmidt, a 15-year-old who died by suicide in 2020 near Camas.
If a 15-year-old can't buy cough syrup like NyQuil or Robitussin at the drugstore, they should not be able to buy a suicide drug on Amazon.
Plaintiffs in the cases say Amazon knew as early as 2018 that it was selling a product that was used for suicide. In 2022, Amazon changed the process for buying sodium nitrite so that purchasers had to get it from a business account. Etsy and eBay stopped selling the product in 2019. Amazon says it can't be held responsible if people misuse its products.
And Minnesota will soon host public hearings on proposed water permit changes as it seeks to get control of nitrate pollution from industrial farms.
This week, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency released its plan to overhaul standards for a pair of water permits issued to the largest animal feedlots in the state. The main focus is livestock operations in areas vulnerable to groundwater pollution. These farms would have to adopt certain practices related to manure application in the fields. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy's Joy Anderson calls the plan a common-sense approach to a pervasive problem. She hopes the public takes notice of what's happening.
People who care about Minnesota's drinking water, people who care about the swimmability and fishability of our water.
Organizations like hers urge residents to speak up during public hearings scheduled for July. The proposed changes are expected to face strong pushback from those representing so-called factory farms. I'm Mike Moen.
This week's move follows a recent order from the federal EPA for Minnesota to clean up contaminated drinking water. Finally, Shantia Hudson lets us know in celebration of Pollinators Month, Charlotte is using its Bee City USA designation to emphasize the crucial role pollinators play in our ecosystem.
Partnering with local beekeepers, the city is working to educate the community, enhance habitats, and reduce pesticide use. Assistant City Arborist Victoria Aguilar notes that while supporting pollinators is simple, many people aren't aware of their importance to everyday life.
One out of every three bites of food that we eat is pollinated by an insect. So you think about all the vegetables that you eat, most of those need insects in order to pollinate, in order to...
Charlotte's efforts are part of the Keep Charlotte Beautiful program.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. Member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations on your favorite podcast platform. And find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, June 27th. Local early morning temperatures range from 57 degrees in Tannersville to 64 in Kinderhook. Air quality is forecast to be good, and that's going to help because today we feel the photons. Skies may start cloudy very early, but they open up by 9 a.m. and we see a high of 80 degrees at 3 p.m. Steady winds this afternoon will help most of the day feel comfortable. Overnight, open up the windows, temperatures fall to 53 degrees, and dew points drop to the 40s. Tomorrow is looking pretty good, high of 77 at 3 p.m. Remember the sunblock and sunglasses, UV exposure will likely be high. Overnight, temperatures fall to 59 degrees, rain shows up for some early on Saturday. That number grows in the afternoon as thunder adds to the mix. High of 77 at 4 p.m. Overnight, rain gets stronger and temperatures fall to only 72 degrees. Sunday is looking icky and rainy with a high of 85. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 1:50 a.m., high tide at 7:45 a.m., low tide again at 2:30 p.m., then high tide once again at 8:32 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 78 degrees and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 8:21 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:18 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be slow at 354 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently okay below 4 megahertz, still dark. Then, okay, across the board overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 135. And this has been the Better Weather for Thursday, June 27th, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Radio? Why should I advertise on radio? There's nothing to look at, no pictures.
Listen, you can do things on radio you couldn't possibly do on TV.
That'll be the day.
All right, watch this. Okay, people, and now when I give you the cue, I want the 700-foot mountain of whipped cream to roll into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will fly overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream for the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain. Cue the Air Force. Cue the maraschino cherry. Okay, 25,000 cheering extras. Now, you want to try that on television?
Well...
You see, radio is a very special medium because it stretches the imagination.
Doesn't television stretch the imagination?
Up to 21 inches, yes.
Now, there's something coming through here that softly reminds me. Tonight I'll park out on the hill and wait until they find me. You're slipping. In the wee hours, your mind gets hazy. Radio relay towers gonna lead me to my baby. Radio's jammed up. Talk till you lose your patience. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Radio's on and I'm moving round the place.
Hey girl, I'm calling all stations, blowing down the wire tonight. I'm singing through these power lines and I'm running on time and feeling alright. Skipping over the currents in the air, reaching to see if you're out there. Come across your radio station, calling out nation to nation. If you can hear me, then say alright. And if you can't, meet me in the city tonight.
Will I turn? Cherry says she's gonna walk, cause she found I took the radio in hot day. I get a call on the short way.
Be a radio player, and you'll hear me sing this song. Transmitting from the gallows floor.
When I lay down at night, I don't get no sleep. So I turn on the radio.
The night speaks in such lights and short with radio's power.
Lost souls calling long distance salvation. Hey, Mr. DJ,
We're talking with Brendan Dunn, who is a journalist who spent part of June over in the West Bank and in Palestine. Been involved previously with Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center. But we wanted to get, you know, a feedback from Brendan over there as a journalist, as I said, and also as an activist. So, Brendan, what was your purpose of being over there in the West Bank?
I went to the West Bank because I felt that I needed to do something, anything really, just in light of what the American government is doing in support of Israel, but the ongoing war and genocide in Gaza, and I'm just feeling helpless where I currently live, which is in Cambodia. But I wanted to do something. I wanted to document what was going on in the West Bank. The first time I was there was just this past year in August, so before the attacks and October 7th and everything that's happened since then. And I went there on assignment with a news organization called Unicorn Riot to work on some stories I had started, but because of the changes in October, that changed everything. And they said it was okay for me to go back to the West Bank, specifically in this refugee camp I spent quite a bit of time in last year and this past June, called Dehesha Refugee Camp, which is located in Bethlehem. So I was there to document life under occupation, under apartheid in the West Bank, and also find those stories about how Palestinians are trying to survive that and also fight back in different ways through nonviolent grassroots organizing and resistance.
Now, obviously, most of the current conflict, at least in terms of the daily attacks by Israel, has been in Gaza, though certainly there's also been damage in the West Bank. Can you maybe, you know, what's the difference between, you know, what lives for people are in the West Bank versus, you know, the situation in Gaza?
Well, the ongoing war and genocide in Gaza is that. It's a full-scale war. It's a mass killing of civilians, and that's something that is ubiquitous. I mean, we see it everywhere all the time in media and social media. You know, the sayings, all eyes are on Gaza, all eyes recently on Rafah, and that's good for people to focus their attention and their concern on Gaza. But there's certainly the occupation continues unabated in the West Bank, across the West Bank. And when I talked to Palestinians while I was there, they said that, yeah, of course, there's this ongoing war in Gaza, and we're doing what we can to try and stop that or speak out against it. It's a very futile, kind of disheartening situation for Palestinians. But they also point out that there's what, in the words of some people I talked to, a slower genocide, a slower ethnic cleansing that is ongoing all the time across the West Bank, in the cities, in the villages, in different towns. And so, yeah, I mean, it's different in many ways, but it's connected, and that is the same. It is the same government. It is the same army that is oppressing both groups of people in Gaza and in the West Bank, and also in domestically, internally, in Israel proper, within the borders of Israel. So, I mean, life is very, very difficult. And the refugee camp I stayed in, Dehesha refugee camp in Bethlehem, the attacks from the army are ongoing. You know, and this is something that, of course, has predated the attacks from Hamas on October 7th, but is intensified. It is far worse. The situation is far worse, not just in that refugee camp, but across the West Bank. And that's something I heard from a number of Palestinians when I was there last August in 2023. And when I talked to a number of Palestinians there in the West Bank, they said, no, this is the worst it's ever been, ever, in their experience, in their personal experience. I talked to one Palestinian woman last year who works for the United Nations. And, you know, after we were stopped at a military checkpoint and the Israeli soldiers had their guns out on me and all the other other Palestinian civilians in this car. And the conversation I had with this a UN representative in the car afterwards was just around that. That was last August. It is profoundly worse now.
Now, you mentioned you spent a lot of your time in this refugee camp by Bethlehem. You know, how much of the West Bank, are people in refugee camps? And what is life, really like in a refugee camp?
This refugee camp, and it is one of many, many, many refugee camps. I don't know off the top of my head how many people live in the camps, but they're everywhere. Just in Bethlehem, there's a few. So as I mentioned, I spent my time in Nehisha. There are two others in Bethlehem. There's many others just south and just north. So to give you an idea of Nehisha refugee camp, it is 17,000 people packed on a hillside in 1 square kilometer. So that's a lot of people in a very small space. I mean, the refugee camp, like the other camps, it was created after the Nakba, what Palestinians generally refer to as the Nakba. That means catastrophe in Arabic. This is the foundation of Israel. And Israel, of course, was founded on genocide and ethnic cleansing, the displacement of many, many Palestinians, over 700,000 of them permanently displaced from their homes, villages razed to the ground. Some villages, like Tantura is one example, where hundreds of people were massacred. They just rounded up the Jewish militia fighters, just rounded up all the men, and their definition of men was ages 10 and above, and just massacred them, executed them. So this refugee camp was created out of refugees from the Nakba, from 1948, and just after that, who lived in villages that were ethnically cleansed, surrounding, most of them surrounding Jerusalem. I mean, for many years, refugees lived in this camp and all the other camps. They lived in tents. They had no access to water, no access to electricity. It was very dangerous, very difficult life. Now, of course, it's built up. I mean, there are little restaurants and little shops. There's mosques in the refugee camp, and there's actually brick and mortar buildings that people live in. But it's very cramped. And, if you live in a refugee camp, there are some, just talking to the residents, they would say benefits. They don't have to pay for water. They don't have to pay for electricity, things like that. But on the flip side of that equation, Israel controls all the water that's going in and out of the West Bank and in and out of the refugee camps. And so the Israeli authorities will just cut off the water for 2 months at a time or a month at a time. So it's very difficult. And as I mentioned, the army raids all the time. So normally what happens is a number of Israeli soldiers will go into the camp, and usually around 5 in the morning or so, they'll storm a house or several houses, they'll terrorize everyone inside, and then they often arrest young men or teenage boys. They will take the young men or boys, and most times they're not accused of anything, they're not charged with anything. If you're arrested, from what I heard from people, if you're arrested by the Israeli army, you will be beaten. And if you go to jail or prison, you will be tortured. And so that's a difficult thing with life in the refugee camp.
And, what do people do for jobs and for food in these camps?
Well, I mean, a number of people, they find jobs elsewhere. And so before October, it was much easier for people to travel to places like Jerusalem, which they have to go through military checkpoints and have special permission, special ID to go there. There are people that work in Jewish settlements, Israeli settlements. So there are people that will work elsewhere in the city of Bethlehem. And of course, there are some people that work in the camp itself. Think of the job. Imagine the job people are working, that job. So I know some people that work in the camp, and or they live in the camp, and they work as tour guides for tourists coming to Bethlehem to see ancient Christian or other historic sites of interest. So it runs the gamut. But since October, things have been very difficult. There's absolutely no freedom of movement. Even before October, there's no freedom of movement that exists. If you're a Palestinian, you do not have that right.
Talking with Brendan Dunn, a journalist who just has returned from particularly the West Bank in Palestine. And so Brendan, you were talking about some of the economic challenges that day-to-day living that people in the refugee camp in Bethlehem you were visiting were facing. How has that just gotten worse, you know, under the present escalated genocide attacks that's going on in Gaza, and how is that, you know, sort of rolled over into the West Bank? You've mentioned the increased, you know, presence of the military, increased confrontation, but what are some of the other aspects?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that has certainly made life much more difficult for Palestinians in the West Bank since October is, this is a special emergency situation. So the laws that do exist, and they barely give any protections or rights to Palestinians, but the ones that do exist to begin with, are many of them were just kind of thrown out the window. So one thing that has changed, I had talked about, I looked into this issue of freedom of movement and the lack thereof. And so there are a number of Palestinians who are just not allowed to go to Jerusalem, for example. And that's because maybe they were political prisoners. Maybe they're politically active. And I don't even mean any kind of form of like violent political activism. It could be nonviolent political activism. So if you go to prison for that, if you're caught for that, then you and often your family are prevented from ever visiting Jerusalem, ever going to the sea, things like that. Since October, since the attacks on October 7th and the ensuing war and genocide in Gaza, I mean, the freedom of movement just became so much worse. So the Israelis changed the rules where very, very few people are allowed to, I should say very few Palestinians now are allowed to go to Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. So in addition to the current restrictions that did exist, or the former ones that did exist, there are these added restrictions based on age, based on where people live, and so on. And so young people, for example, are generally barred from going to Al-Aqsa Mosque now. There's an issue with what's called a flying checkpoint, and that's where Israeli soldiers and military vehicles will just randomly set up different checkpoints in the heart of Bethlehem, in the city of Bethlehem, outside of this refugee camp, etc. They're doing this all over the West Bank, and just to make life difficult for Palestinians. It's something that I encountered when I was there just recently in June. So that's another thing that's difficult. And I mean, the repression is so much worse. I mean, just one last example is that I talked to many young people in this refugee camp. They feel absolutely helpless with this ongoing war and genocide in Gaza. It is so close yet so far away at the same time. So if you're a young person, politically concerned about human rights, you want an end to the war and genocide, and you post something about that on Instagram or Facebook, and it could be as something as innocuous or mild as end the war, stop the genocide. If the army, someone from the army, Israeli army, sees that you posted that, it is likely that they will go to your family's house. They will raid it in the morning, 5 a.m, terrorize your family, grab you, and then throw you in jail for maybe 6 months or a year or 2 years in what's called administrative detention. And that's getting thrown in jail without charge, really without reason. And you could languish in there for a very long time.
So we have about 5 minutes left. So I'm going to ask sort of a two-part question, but you should just, you know, what do you want to convey that we haven't talked about? So the two-part question is, you know, to what extent have people from Gaza been able to, you know, get into the West Bank, which seems to be a little bit safer than in the Gaza situation? And then, you know, second, as, you know, these discussions take place about ceasefires and some type of permanent solutions, how is the West Bank both being able to voice their vision of how do we, you know, move forward, and are they being consulted at all?
So there are some people from Gaza. I mean, they're born refugees and they're again refugees who have trickled out and gone to the West Bank. And have been taken in by Palestinian, other Palestinian families or humanitarian organizations. The numbers are very, very small, very limited. And just in terms of what people envision in the West Bank, and I'm thinking more in lines of what's the solution here, and talking to a lot of people about that. It's difficult for people to imagine that. So many people I've talked to, they're just trying to survive one day at a time and survive this occupation. I think what gave me some hope in the people from the people in the West Bank that are trying to fight for some alternative and some solution. And I think for most people, that would be a one state solution, one person, one vote, equal rights for everyone, no matter what their ethnicity, nationality, previous nationality, or their religious identity, et cetera, is. And that's been the longstanding goal of a vast majority of the Palestinian population, that or a two state solution. These are two things that the Israeli government has never wanted. And now with the most extremist elements now driving at the helm in the Israeli government, this is the most far right wing government that's ever existed in the history of Israel. That seems more and more impossible, but people are still persisting. They're still resisting and fighting. And so I saw that in the grassroots activism and organizing in the Hisha refugee camp, in the city of Bethlehem, also in the city of Hebron. There's quite a bit of that going on there, and it's very inspirational. And this is a city where there's an illegal Israeli occupation in the heart of the old city, where 1,700 Palestinian shops have been shut down over the years, and they have to deal with violent attacks from settlers and also from soldiers all the time there. But people are resisting in creative ways all over the West Bank.
So about 2.5 minutes less, another two-part question. You mentioned previously nonviolence theory. How is that being discussed or manifested? And how do people in the West Bank, feel about what, Hamas has done? Hamas is more, I guess, politically dominant in Gaza opposed to the West Bank.
Yeah, so what's interesting, the refugee camp I stayed in, and this is true of the camps in Bethlehem, but elsewhere too, but there's the more political, the more popular political opinions in that camp are communists and socialists and left-wing. And you hear that in the conversations with the people. You see that in the dominance and presence of the organizations there. You see it in the graffiti and the artwork and the murals everywhere in that refugee camp. There aren't really that many Hamas supporters in that camp. I mean, it's 17,000 people, so there's going to be a couple. But by and large, it's very left wing, and a lot of the
Hamas is more religious based, correct?
Yeah, Hamas. I mean, Hamas is a reactionary right wing resistance organization. It's far right wing Muslim. But what's interesting with Hamas is, honestly, I think they were really only able to come to power because so many years ago in Gaza. Because they painted themselves as the anti-corruption party. They are not the party that signed on to the Oslo peace agreements, which the PLO did and other groups in Palestine did. And they really toned down their religious and violent rhetoric. So it wasn't just Muslims, it was Christians and other people that voted for them in Gaza as well, thinking that they would bring some kind of change. In terms of support for Hamas and conversations I've had for people, as an American and as a Western journalist in the West Bank and in these refugee camps, I wanted that kind of question to come up organically on its own in the conversation. So I wasn't asking it that much. I didn't want to ask about that one day in the 75 plus years of genocide and war and ethnic cleansing, occupation and apartheid that people have been facing. So, it did come up in some ways, but by and large, the political opinions of people I talked to, they were on the left. They're on the left, and there's that critique that does exist of Hamas and a preference for that grassroots kind of organizing resistance and to occupation and to apartheid.
Thank you very much. We've been talking to Brendan Dunn. I understand you're going to be publishing some articles.
Yes, I'll be publishing a series of articles over the next few months. The first ones should come out on the Hishi refugee camp in July sometime on the website Unicorn Riot.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
The Mush Hole is a theatrical dance performance about truths of Canada's first Indian residential school, the Mohawk Institute. From 1828 to 1970, state and church attempted to forcefully assimilate children from Six Nations and surrounding First Nations into Euro-Christian society and sever the continuity of culture from parent to child. The Iroquois Museum is presenting this performers by the Gahawi Dance Theater, and I'm now joined by Colette Limon, curator of exhibitions at the Iroquois Museum. Thank you so much for joining me for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Oh, thanks for having us on here.
So dressing the history and continued trauma from residential schools is a very difficult task. How does the Mush Hole use music and theater to acknowledge the past and its current legacy?
One of the things I think we should mention, right, although this story is set at the Mush Hole, which is wasn't a school in Canada, the United States as well has a 150-year-old history of residential schools that Native children attended, in most cases forcibly. So the story, although it is set in Canada, is an American story as well. The idea behind the unacknowledged part of our American history, Gahawi Theater, the creator of this, the artistic director who was inspired to tell this story and bring it to the stage, Santee Smith, her grandfather and her great-grandmother both attended this school, so it's both a personal story as well as, you know, a story that impacted, you know, Native culture, Indigenous people throughout in North America.
So you mentioned the creator's connection to the story. There was also other testimony. What do you know about the research that went into using past experiences and the experiences of two generations to create this performance?
From my understanding, Santee and individuals that worked on the project with her actually sat down with survivors from the residential school experience in her community and basically listened to these stories that in some cases, you know, have not been told or shared even with family members. And then I think they also went through documents and records. But a lot of it is based on one-to-one stories that these elders chose to share and entrusted to the Gahawi Dance Theater to make public, which is a really courageous thing to do, but also very important.
Bricks are instrumental in the set design. What are some of the stage elements and visual information that are used to convey the weight and trauma that this play is addressing?
I've only seen stills from the performance. I have not seen the performance yet. It has not been performed in the States very often. So this will be my first time actually seeing the full performance. I believe the bricks, it is something I did want to check with Santee, because I believe that the school, there were three schools built on the same site of the Mohawk Institute. And I believe that the bricks may be from that particular site, in which case, if they are the actual bricks from the school that are used in the story, there's a resonance in the fact that these bricks were actually part of this, you know, physically part of this school. And if they are not the actual bricks, it's really a reference, a symbolic reference to the walls that both block the children from their families, from their communities, but also, again, the harshness of the environment, the militaristic sort of environment that the kids were raised in, almost like it was almost an incarceration.
You mentioned that the U.S., the states have a history of residential schools, and near Buffalo, there was the Thomas Indian School. Has New York State made any effort to remedy its participation in the history of residential schools?
Not that I know of. I know there have been some efforts within the records for Thomas Indian School. Many of the records are at the New York State Archives, and photographs and actual records, the children's records. I don't believe the State Museum has not done an exhibition with those materials that I know of. The Seneca Nation, some individuals from the Seneca Nation actually created a commentary, started as a photo commentary, response to the Thomas Indian School experience. But I don't believe that New York State has done anything significant to address and acknowledge the impact of these schools on generations of Native kids.
The Gahawi Dance Theater is coming to the Capital Region this weekend on June 29th. Where can this performance be experienced?
The performance will be at SUNY Albany Performing Arts Center, which is the Uptown campus on Washington Avenue. I think it holds 400 seats or something like that. The performance is free. It will be followed with a question and answer with Santi and her dance company. And that is, it's at 7:30. When I go to college campuses, if I'm not familiar with them, I end up driving around for hours trying to find particular buildings. And what we want to do, we're going to put a university map up on the Iroquois Museum Facebook page.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Iroquois Museum?
The museum is, we're doing the performance in Albany because we wanted, first of all, to be able to draw from a larger population. The museum is in a very rural area. Contemporary dance can be a bit of a hard sell, even though this is really storytelling through dance. So we wanted to do it where we would be able to get the most receptive large audience. So we rented the space in Albany, which had the capacity to host this in the way that it is supposed to be presented. The museum is in Schoharie County, which is very rural, and we are near Howell's Caverns, which everyone knows where that is, the commercial Howell Caverns, and near Cobleskill. We were founded in 1981, and we are, the museum basically looks at and collects and presents Haudenosaunee art from 1980 to today. And the arts are what we have decided is a wonderful way to invite Haudenosaunee people to share their culture with non-natives and natives throughout the United States and other parts of the world. So we have a very large art collection, and we host a changing exhibit every year. This year, the reason we're doing the Mush Hole is because this year the show is called Outside the Box, and is showcasing 10 Haudenosaunee creatives who have chosen ways to express that are not what you what most people would expect indigenous art to be. And it's everything from an Iroquois marching band to a photojournalist to a woman who works in steel sculpture to a burlesque dancer from Ganawage, which is just outside of Montreal. So it's a really wide diversity of expressions. Santee is, there are very few indigenous dance companies, and Santee's is one, and they've been around since 2005. So we wanted to showcase what Gahawi Dance Theater has been doing since 2005. So that was how, one of the part of the programming that was related to that exhibition. So we do artist demonstrations, artist talks, workshops, dance performances, and of course, you know, school programs and a big Labor Day festival. So we're open 9 months a year. We close in the winter. We tear everything apart and do something different and open April 1st again.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about the Mush Hole and the Iroquois Museum.
I guess the one thing I'd really like to mention is that, you know, although this is a really painful part of our shared history, the ultimate message in bringing these stories to the stage and what Gahawi Dance Theater intends is that, along with acknowledging what occurred, is that there is this idea of resilience and that there is light in dark places. In the end, it's a very inspiring story of truth.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is something that, again, would enable the Speaker of the House to order the Sergeant at Arms to take into custody the Attorney General if he fails to comply with our request.
Florida Republican Representative Anna Paulina Luna will force a vote on an inherent contempt resolution against Attorney General Merrick Garland. Garland was held in contempt of Congress for not turning over tapes of President Joe Biden's interview with Special Prosecutor Robert Hur, but the Department of Justice, led by the AG, has refused to act. Inherent contempt requires the House Sergeant at Arms to bring the accused before the chamber to be tried and possibly detained. Like much of what the House has done recently, this hasn't happened in almost a century. While some wonder if this will distract from governing, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says having the audio is imperative.
We've got to have the audio tape to confirm what is on the written transcript. There's been admission that they edited the transcript in some ways. We need to know in what ways, and why is it so important?
Speaker Johnson says he's eager to see Trump's performance at tonight's televised debate, arguing Biden will pale by comparison to the former president. He says Trump's plans for the country will settle any doubts. The Biden campaign is dismissing Trump camp charges the president will use drugs to improve his debate performance. One spokesperson calls demands for a drug test silly. 2 years after the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, a Guttmacher Institute report says the number of abortions increased and more are via medications. Also, new analysis from the Institute for Women's Policy Research shows financial costs of abortion bans. Dr. Jamila K. Taylor is with the IWPR.
The 16 states that have either an abortion ban or extreme restriction cost the national economy $68 billion alone. For states that actually protect abortion, those states actually reduce these costs.
Their research says Arkansas, Mississippi, and Missouri would have slightly higher GDPs if they removed abortion restrictions, while women's labor force participation nationwide would vastly increase. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden's executive actions to limit southern border crossings seem to be working. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says there have been significant changes.
Border patrol encounters have dropped by over 40%. We are removing more non-citizens without a legal basis to stay here, nearly doubling the rate at which we are removing non-citizens directly from Border Patrol custody.
Yesterday marked the 11th anniversary of the Supreme Court's ruling on Shelby County v. Holder, which overturned parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act and made it easier for states to put up barriers to voting. Alabama Democratic Representative Terry Sewell says the impacts since the decision are devastating for voters' rights.
We have seen 31 states institute at least 103 new laws to restrict voting access. And it is no surprise that those laws disproportionately target Black and minority voters.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported recently on the impact of Shelby County versus Holder, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision invalidating Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Anticipating even more erosion of the VRA, some states have passed their own state VRAs. It's not only the dismantling of Section 5, the preclearance requirements for states with a history of discrimination. The conservative justices also made proving racial gerrymandering harder under Section 2, and they've made it easier for a state legislature to dilute minority voting power. And in the lower courts, more cases attempting to keep individual voters from bringing voting rights lawsuits under the VRA are pending. With dwindling protections from the federal government, California, Washington, Oregon, Virginia, New York, Connecticut, and Minnesota have enacted state VRAs. Michigan, Maryland, New Jersey, and Florida have efforts underway. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund recommends that state VRAs should have preclearance requirements for municipalities which have patterns of discrimination. Rules should include a prohibition against vote denial or dilution through gerrymandering, strong protections against intimidation or deception, language assistance, a statewide database to make evidence-based decisions on election administration, and a directive to the state judiciary to support pro-voter and pro-democracy decisions. We have the recommendations at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hello and welcome to the Better Weather for Thursday, June 27th. Local early morning temperatures range from 57 degrees in Tannersville to 64 in Kinderhook. Air quality is forecast to be good, and that's going to help because today we feel the photons. Skies may start cloudy very early, but they open up by 9 a.m. and we see a high of 80 degrees at 3 p.m. Steady winds this afternoon will help most of the day feel comfortable. Overnight, open up the windows, temperatures fall to 53 degrees, and dew points drop to the 40s. Tomorrow is looking pretty good, high of 77 at 3 p.m. Remember the sunblock and sunglasses, UV exposure will likely be high. Overnight, temperatures fall to 59 degrees, rain shows up for some early on Saturday. That number grows in the afternoon as thunder adds to the mix. High of 77 at 4 p.m. Overnight, rain gets stronger and temperatures fall to only 72 degrees. Sunday is looking icky and rainy with a high of 85. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 1:50 a.m., high tide at 7:45 a.m., low tide again at 2:30 p.m., then high tide once again at 8:32 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 78 degrees and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 8:21 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:18 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be slow at 354 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently okay below 4 MHz till dark, then okay across the board overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 135. And this has been the Better Weather for Thursday, June 27th, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Revolution. Foment. Revolution. Foment. A verb. Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to foment. 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 A verb. Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to foment. He worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse, incite. Though he seemed loyal in public, he worked foment the scenes to verb. Foment, revolution. Though he seemed loyal, worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse, incite. Though he seems loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to foment. He worked revolution scenes to stir up, arouse. He worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse, incite. He worked behind the scenes to. Though he seems loyal in public, he worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse, incite, revolution. Though he seemed loyal in public, foment went behind the scenes. Though he seemed loyal in public, worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse, incite, revolution. Foment, a verb. Foment. Revolution. Worked behind the scenes to stir up, arouse. He worked behind the scenes to though he stir up, loyal, public. Though he seemed working behind the scenes to foment, a verb. Foment, a verb. Though he seems loyal, public. Though he seems loyal behind the scenes.
Revolution. He were men.